Interlude. Headed home. As far as clues went, it wasn't much to go on, except for one thing. Most of the trails in Chapo Guzman's life led back to his home in Sinaloa. In 1957, when he was born in the small town of La Tuna, up in the Sierras, the Russians launched Sputnik, Elvis Presley was drafted by the Army, and American Bandstand debuted on TV. But these events would likely not have meant much in the far-flung village of his childhood. La Tuna was in its own world then, an isolated cattle town without much indoor plumbing or a public sewage system. Its few hundred residents largely lived in poverty, many of them in simple dirt-floored homes, far from the luxuries of modern schools or hospitals. The Guzman family was no exception. The kingpin's father, Emilio Guzman, fed his seven children on his income as a farmer and a rancher, and his wife, Maria, tried her best to keep them all in line with her pious Christian faith. With three older siblings already ahead of him, Guzman grew up sleeping in a tomato box cribbed from the family's farmstead, where he later helped his father milk the cows and tend to his beans and maize. While his early years were not without their pleasures, hula hoops, marbles, hunting in the hillsides, life for the most part was filled with daily labor. Among the kingpin's first jobs was selling candy and his mother's bread to the neighbors. When his formal education ended in the third grade, Guzman was put to work on the family's major cash crop, the poppies that they raised and sold for opium. Long before there was a Sinaloa drug cartel, there were drugs in Sinaloa. The state's first opium trade reaches back to the 19th century, when Chinese merchants who had settled in the area set up networks to grow and harvest poppies in the highlands outside Mazatlan and ship their gummy resins to dealers across the border. By the time of the revolution in 1910, native growers, called gummers or gomeros, had gotten into the business, squeezing the flowers for their pale narcotic paste and sending it north, often using smuggling routes that were later blazed during Prohibition. With the start of World War II, American gangsters, deprived of pipelines in Turkey and the Balkans, set their eyes on Mexico, and men like Bugsy Siegel created large-scale heroin operations on the state's Pacific coast. Since time immemorial, marijuana had also been a staple in the Golden Triangle, the tri-state region that ranged from Sinaloa into Durango and Chihuahua. Starting in the 1950s, the sales and production of Sinaloan opium and pot were largely overseen by a young man named Pedro Avilés Pérez, who was one of Guzmán's uncles. Avilés, a doctor from the town of Badiraguato, south along the main state highway from La Tuna, was a pioneer of the Sinaloan drug trade, the first local trafficker to move his merchandise in planes to the United States and to systematically foster ties with powerful policemen. By the mid-1960s, Avilés had solidified his place as one of Sinaloa's most innovative distributors and as a chief supplier to the counterculture movements in the north. It is also possible that Avilés brought his nephew into the business of dealing drugs. In 1973, Guzman left La Tuna, or as some have argued, was thrown out of the house by his father, and at age 16, took up with his future wife, Alejandrina Salazar, whom he had met at a party in Culiacán. That same year, according to an interview he gave to Javier Rey, he carried out his first run as a smuggler, driving an old Ford pickup truck packed with pot across the American border. Pedro Avilés was killed in Culiacán by the federal police in 1978, and his sudden death thrust the drug trade into one of its earliest periods of chaos. It is almost certain that the old world boss was betrayed by a cabal of his subordinates. The plot to remove him was likely hatched by one of Avilés's top aides, Miguel Ángel Félix Gallardo, who seized control of the underworld and ultimately served as Guzmán's second mentor. Tall, handsome, and gifted with a shrewd sense of politics, Félix Gallardo had started his career as a state policeman, detailed at one point as the personal bodyguard of Sinaloa's governor. In his early 30s, while working for Avilés, He became consumed by an ambition to improve and expand the local empire his employer had created. The Mexican drug trade was still at that point a disorganized collection of individual fiefdoms whose leaders often competed for police protection, supply chains, and profitable smuggling routes. Félix Gallardo's vision was to unify the industry into a single organization. Through consolidation and economies of scale, he hoped to create a kind of supergroup that could boost production and streamline distribution while reducing violence and centralizing the handing out of bribes. With Aviles out of the way, Félix Gallardo founded what came to be known as the Guadalajara Drug Cartel, which Guzmán joined as a low-level functionary in the late 1970s. It was in Guadalajara that the eager novice learned the logistics of the business, working side by side with Félix Gallardo's partners, Rafael Caro Quintero and Don Neto Fonseca Carrillo. The new cartel in Guadalajara not only had creative leadership and began growing pot on an industrial scale at vast plantations staffed by hundreds of pickers, it was also blessed with a deep bench of secondary players who would themselves eventually rise to power in the drug trade. During his time in Guadalajara, Guzmán formed significant relationships with men like Mayo Zambada and Don Neto's nephew, Amado Carrillo Fuentes, that would last throughout his career. Everything changed for both the Guadalajara cartel and for Chapo Guzmán with the American cocaine boom of the early 1980s. Traditionally, the business of cocaine had been based in Colombia, where the powder was produced and where drug world titans like Pablo Escobar and the Orejuela brothers had held sway for a decade. Their business model was simple and exceptionally profitable. Cocaine was manufactured in clandestine labs, often in the rainforest jungle, then sailed by speedboats across the Caribbean to landing points in Florida. Sometimes the barons in Medellin and Cali entrusted distribution of their product to their own employees in Miami or New York. Sometimes they contracted jobs to American middlemen. All of this was suddenly disrupted by the Reagan administration. In 1982, 1 year after Time magazine declared cocaine the all-American drug, the White House put together the South Florida Task Force, a multi-district team of nearly a dozen state and federal agencies, to crack down on the traffic from Colombia. Maritime blockades shut Caribbean shipping routes, and radar planes patrolled the skies for boats that had managed to elude the naval dragnet. Within 4 years, the task force had seized 100,000 pounds of cocaine, 6 million pounds of marijuana, and racked up more than 15,000 arrests. The Colombians needed a new business model, and standing by in Mexico, Félix Gallardo had one. His Guadalajaran smugglers had for years been moving marijuana across the U.S. border and were highly skilled at negotiating the often porous 2,000-mile frontier. Such skill came at a premium, however, and Félix Gallardo named his price. He wanted more than a shipping fee for transporting Colombian cocaine to American consumers. He wanted a percentage of the business. It was under the terms of this arrangement that Guzmán, who was in his early 30s, became a full-time bandit at the border. While he was not at first the busiest smuggler in Mexico, he quickly proved himself to be among the fastest and most daring. His initial nickname was El Rápido. In those first years, he focused on a single border crossing, the one connecting Agua Prieta, Mexico, to Douglas, Arizona, moving his merchandise from one town to the other in family-style motorhomes, and later through his greatest innovation, cross-border tunnels, including one that his engineers disguised beneath a pool table. From 1987 to 1989, the American authorities estimate that Guzmán's operation passed as many as 10 tons of cocaine each year across or underneath the Arizona border. The business earned him his initial fortune of tens of millions of dollars. The now familiar structure of the Mexican drug trade, a landscape in which multiple cartels vie for power from separate home-based territories, started taking shape in 1989 with the arrest of Félix Gallardo and the demise of his cartel. The DEA had made the capo and his partners its primary targets in 1985, following the brutal torture and murder of a DEA agent based in Guadalajara, Enrique Camarena. When the Mexican military tracked down Felix Gallardo 4 years later and captured him in Guadalajara, where he had been a frequent guest of police and politicians, his empire split apart. His allies and lieutenants each grabbed a piece of what remained, or, as some have noted, were given sinecures with his permission. Amado Carrillo Fuentes and his brothers seized control of Ciudad Juarez. Another clan of brothers, the Arellano Felix family, took over Tijuana. Guzman and Mayo Zambada were granted rights to the homeland, Sinaloa, and its long Pacific coast. With a turf to call his own, Guzman quickly flourished. He established his own relationships with Colombian suppliers, bought his own policemen, and set up an extensive aerial operation that flew cocaine from southern sources to secret airstrips throughout the Mexican heartland. In the late 1980s, Guzman employed as few as 20 people, many of them longtime friends or relatives like his older brother Arturo. But by the early 1990s, his payroll expanded to about 200. While cocaine remained his profit center, his marijuana business was humming along at 5 to 10 tons every year. He even started cautiously to investigate branching into heroin. In retrospect, the first years of the 90s were Guzman's golden years. He was in large part working under the radar, earning as much as $20 million a month and plowing the profits into beach homes, Lear jets, pleasure boats, zoo animals, and trips to Thailand, Aruba, and Macau. What he didn't spend on himself, he often lavished on his staff in the form of imported sports cars and diamond-encrusted watches. Even so, there was so much money pouring in that his stash houses groaned with cash, and one of his first employees, Miguel Angel Martinez, regularly went to a bank in Mexico City to make deposits from a suitcase stuffed with tens of millions of dollars. In the early 90s, as Martinez once put it, were the best thing in the world. A success like that was bound to foster envy and dissent, and the first place the discord started to emerge was in Tijuana with the Arellano Felix brothers. The nominal cause of the conflict was Mayo Zambada's decision to stop doing business with the brothers. Responding in kind, the Arellano Felixes cut off access to the city, a crucial border crossing, to Zambada and his allies. When Guzman stubbornly ignored their order, it ignited a skirmish that erupted into war. It was Guzman's first war, and it did not end well. In November 1992, the novice kingpin sent a band of gunmen to Christine, a popular nightclub in Puerto Vallarta, having received intelligence that the Arellano Felixes would be there. Guzman's assassins, pulling rifles from their coats, fired at the crowd, shooting out the disco lights. While they killed several bystanders and a few enemy soldiers, they missed their target, the Tijuana leader Ramon Arellano Felix. 6 months later, Ramon and his brothers struck back at the Guadalajara airport. In one of the most storied murders in modern Mexican history, Juan Jesus Posadas Ocampo, a Roman Catholic cardinal, was caught in the crossfire of a team of assassins hired to take out Guzman. Though Guzman escaped the hit unharmed, fleeing into the terminal, then out a back door and into a passing taxi, he was blamed for Ocampo's death, and a nationwide manhunt was launched to track him down. With a phony passport and a timely bribe, he managed to escape to Guatemala, but there was too much pressure to return him, and in June 1993, the Guatemalan government sent the kingpin back to Mexico, where he was tried, convicted, and imprisoned. Already wealthy and now world famous, Guzman made the most of the 8 years he spent in the Puente Grande prison, a high-security facility on the edge of Guadalajara. Through generous payments to the prison's deputy warden, Damaso López, who would one day serve as his chief of staff, he purchased a life of pampered luxury. Within the walls of Puente Grande, the kingpin enjoyed the finest food and liquor, a personal chef, and conjugal visits from his wives and jailhouse girlfriend. He continued to run and expand his business, relaying his orders on a contraband phone to his brother Arturo, who set up an apartment near his home in Acapulco, expressly to receive the regular calls. Though Guzman seethed about the Arellano Felix brothers, who never paid a price for Cardinal Ocampo's murder, his most pressing problem was avoiding being sent across the border to face a more exacting form of justice. By the end of the 90s, he had been indicted in both Tucson and San Diego on a wide range of American federal charges. One day after Mexico's Supreme Court legalized extradition to the United States, Guzman disappeared from Puente Grande. His escape on January 19, 2001, is a chapter of criminal lore that, like the Brinks job or the Lufthansa heist, has long been mired in conflict and conspiracy. Some say Guzman slipped out of the prison dressed as a woman in a wig and high heels. Some say he paid a federal judge to set him free. Some claim that he bribed Vicente Fox, then the president of Mexico, who simply let him walk out the front door. Others with a more nuanced understanding of Mexican corruption say that Guzman was in possession of so much dirt by then about the government's own involvement in the drug trade that he was released as a precautionary measure, free of charge. The official position of the United States government may be the most improbable version of them all. According to this account, one of Guzman's lawyers paid off dozens of guards at Puente Grande, those at the doors, those controlling the security cameras, and those who manned the boom gate in the parking lot, to look the other way as a maintenance worker named El Chito wheeled the kingpin out of the facility in a laundry cart and hit him in the trunk of his car. Waiting near the prison was a second car, an armored Volkswagen Jetta, which hurried Guzman through the night to a safe house in the city of Tepic. Some days later, as the military neared Tepic, Mayo Zambada, tipped off by President Fox's bodyguard, rescued Guzman by sending him a helicopter. When the helicopter landed, Mayo's brother, Rey, drove the kingpin hundreds of miles through roadblocks and checkpoints to Mexico City in the back of yet a third car. As the two men entered the capital, Guzman became alarmed when a police squad car and motorcycle pulled up next to their vehicle. Rey Zambada told him not to worry. These police, he calmly said, were their police. The getaway certified Guzman as Mexico's most legendary outlaw. More important, it brought about a pivotal moment in the history of the Sinaloa drug cartel. After a celebratory party, Guzman and Zambada finally reunited, stayed up talking until dawn. Guzman confessed that after his stint in prison, he was broke. Zambada, like a wise older brother, told him to take care of himself and generously offered to help him out with money. The two old colleagues spoke about their business and the future of their business, and by the time the sun rose on the ranch to which they had retreated after leaving Mexico City, they came to an agreement to merge their operations into what would soon become one of the most profitable partnerships in the annals of organized crime. Vowing themselves to one another, they swore that moving forward they would split their earnings equally. "I'm with you 100%, Zambada is said to have declared. "Any kilo of coke that I receive, I'm going to give half to you." Once the deal was struck and sealed, Guzman, following a well-worn trail, headed home to the mountains of Sinaloa. Act 2. Crackberry. Wherever information gathers and flows, two predators follow closely behind it: censorship and surveillance. Sarah Jiang, writing in The Atlantic, April 2016. 5. The Office. February 2012 through October 2012. With helicopters hovering and an army of policemen on his tail, Chapo Guzman was a fugitive again. After getting off the beach in Punta Ballena, he made his way to a car and hurried north, moving up the Trans-Peninsular Highway to an airstrip in La Paz, where his bodyguard Condor had arranged a private plane. Whatever just happened, it must have been a disconcerting wake-up call. Not since his arrest in 1993 had the authorities, let alone the gringo authorities, come so close to catching him. As he later told his wife, he had seen them coming at the final moment and rushed out the back door of the mansion, sprinting past his swimming pool and leaping over the low wall of his deck. He had left the house so fast, there had been no time to grab his laptop, his address book, even his underwear. 10 p.m. I saw them pounding on the door next door, and I was able to jump out. 10:01 p.m. Oh, love, that's horrible. When he got back to Culiacan that night and moved into a safe house on a quiet street in the seedy neighborhood of Colonia Libertad, Guzman did his usual post-mortem. Losing the address book was bad, but losing the laptop was considerably worse. The computer's files contained his FlexiSpy accounts, and as the days went by, he began to worry that whoever had it now could search his browser history and find them. In the interests of security, he asked one of his tech chiefs, Charlie Martinez, to reach out to the young Colombian, Christian Rodriguez, who had set the system up, and have him change the passwords. While it might have been a wiser course to have gotten rid of the program altogether, Guzman was eager to know who had betrayed him in Los Cabos. It could easily have been one of his own people, and if that was the case, then he could not afford to shut the spyware down. What he did shut down were Rodriguez's secret cell phones. Not long after settling into Culiacan, Guzman issued an order to his staff. From here on, he announced, everyone around him was going to work exclusively on Blackberries. The encrypted Nokias had fallen out of his favor, and by that point, he had largely moved to Blackberries himself. Many of his closest aides, and all of his wives and girlfriends, were also using Blackberries by then, the ones infected with the FlexiSpy malware. The abrupt change in methods did not appear, at least at first, to suggest a lack of trust in Christian Rodriguez. Rather, Guzman seems to have believed that Blackberries were simply more secure than other available devices, and after the breach in Cabo, they needed more security. Many drug traffickers were under that impression. There was a general consensus at the time that BlackBerry's chatting service, BBM, offered more protections than competing texting apps. The system's messages moved phone to phone, not by way of ordinary numbers, but instead by way of mostly anonymous alphanumeric pins. It was also common knowledge, at least to those who made a point of knowing, that the company's servers were in Canada, safe from the eyes and ears of the American federal government. BlackBerry users could purchase special add-ons from outside firms that enhanced the device's normal safeguards. One of them, Phantom Secure, customized off-the-shelf handsets with additional encryption and routed BBM chats through servers in Panama and Hong Kong, places that were famously unhelpful to law enforcement agents. There was only one drawback to the BlackBerries. Their native encryption system was much less robust than the one the Nokias had. To compensate for this, Guzman put in place a clever new method of protecting himself against the menace of surveillance. Moving forward, he decided, his organization's BBM chats would not be sent directly from one phone to another. Instead, they would be channeled through a kind of message web, a network of filters he came to call the Office. As he envisioned it, the Office would be shaped like a pyramid. At its lowest, fattest level were his operatives in the field, everyone from pilots in Ecuador to couriers in Phoenix. To send the boss a message, the field-level workers would pass it up to a first tier of go-betweens using Blackberries with screen names like Office 1 or Office 2. These 10 or so office-level workers would then take screenshots of the messages or copy them by hand and pushed them on to a second tier of filters. They had devices screen-named Telcel and USACell. The Telcel-level workers would forward the messages further up the chain, this time to Condor, Guzman's bodyguard, or to Condor's partner, another former soldier named Chaneke. At the top of pyramid, Condor and Chaneke would deliver the messages to Guzman himself. He could then send comments or responses in the opposite direction on the same circuitous path. When Guzman established the office in the early months of 2012, one of his first steps was to set up what amounted to call centers for his office and Telcel-level workers. In the call centers, his beleaguered cutouts gorged themselves on junk food and worked around the clock on arrays of numbered BlackBerries, relaying messages up and down the pyramid. The centers were often housed in ordinary homes in ordinary neighborhoods of ordinary cities. The earliest seemed to have been based in Tepic, just south of Sinaloa. Imagine General Motors installing an army of assistants in an apartment in Topeka and ordering them to transcribe the emails of the company's top executives all day long, 7 days a week, and then to pass their notes on to a second group of similar assistants. From the outside, the call centers didn't look like much, but from within, they were furious hives, serving as the switchboard for Guzman's sprawling empire. With the office up and running, Guzman returned to work that spring with a kind of refreshed ferocity. As the shock of Cabo started to recede, his business stabilized and his interests were as various as ever. His staple product, Colombian cocaine, was still arriving by the ton load from suppliers in the country, helped along by transshipment teams working out of cattle ranches and melon farms in Honduras and Guatemala. His marijuana profits had slipped in recent years, but bales of pot continued to come down to him from loyal farmers based in the Sierras. Though Jorge Cifuentes had fled to Venezuela after his indictment, Guzman maintained his project in Ecuador, changing some key players but keeping the smuggling route more or less intact. His border teams, meanwhile, were making frequent crossings at Nogales, Agua Prieta, and Ciudad Juarez, despite the war that had been raging there for years. A central focus of his efforts at the time was building up his operations in Canada. While Guzman had been shipping drugs to Canada since at least 2008, its busy cities, wide expanses, and open borders with the United States had persuaded him that there was room for growth. It hadn't gone unnoticed that a kilo of cocaine sold for almost $10,000 more in Montreal and Toronto than it did in Chicago or Los Angeles. In Cabo, Alex Cifuentes, whose ex-wife was Canadian, had introduced Guzman to a few potential customers from Canada. When they were back in Culiacan, Alex began arranging more meetings about deals in the country in Guzman's house in Colonia Libertad. Among those who met with the kingpin was Stephen Tello, a 30-something real estate agent from Toronto. After dropping out of college, Tello, who was of Colombian descent, had bounced around through jobs in finance and precious metals, but ultimately landed in the drug trade, for which he had a talent. With Alex acting as their translator, Tello and Guzman soon reached an agreement. The kingpin's people, supervised by Damaso Lopez, would ferry loads of cocaine and methamphetamine across the Mexican border to warehouses in Los Angeles. From there, one of Tello's men, a truck fleet owner nicknamed Russian Mike, would move the product up the West Coast in tractor trailers equipped with secret compartments. When the drugs reached Canada, they would fall back under Alex's supervision. Guzman now considered Canada to be of such importance to his larger operation that he sent one of his nephews, Mario, there to serve as his man on the ground. The route in Canada took off like a rocket. In due course, shipments of cocaine were being flown by helicopter from bases in Seattle to isolated ranches near Vancouver. Other loads made their way east to Montreal under the protection of the Hell's Angels and were sold on the streets by the Rizzuto crime family, the city's top mafia group. Greek grocers got involved, and eventually a crew of Iranian gangsters. The excitement of exploiting a new market seemed to spark Guzman's creativity. Soon there were discussions about flying merchandise to Canada on seaplanes, driving it over Lake Champlain on speedboats from Vermont, and dropping it into the countryside on GPS-guided parachutes. That same spring, in search of further conquests, Guzman turned his attention to one of his oldest pastimes, expanding his holdings at the border. He had always had a sixth sense for detecting weakness in competitors, and scanning the horizon, he now saw an opening in Nuevo Laredo, the bustling border town south of Texas, controlled by his longtime enemies, the Zetas. The Zetas were a unique phenomenon of the drug trade in Mexico. Their founders had started their careers as professional soldiers, serving in an airborne special forces unit called the GAFE, or the Grupo Aeromóvil de Fuerzas Especiales. Highly trained in counterinsurgency and small arms tactics, they were deployed for a time in the brutal fight against the country's drug cartels. In the late 1990s, however, a handful of the soldiers were lured from the military by Ociel Cárdenas, the erstwhile boss of the Gulf cartel, to work as his private army and to help him keep control of his organization and its base in Nuevo Laredo. When Cárdenas was arrested in 2003, the Zetas started to strike out on their own, taking over his smuggling routes and moving into ancillary rackets like kidnapping and extortion. The infighting and instability this created caught Guzman's eye. That same year, drafting his own private army, Los Negros, or the Black Ones, the kingpin launched his first invasion of Nuevo Laredo. But the Zetas proved too much for him, and he eventually retreated. 9 years later, not much had changed. In March 2012, even as the kingpin was setting up his new Canadian business, a convoy of soldiers stormed Nuevo Laredo in a deliberate assault against the Zetas' boss in the city, Gerardo Guerra Valdez. A skilled tactician, Guerra Valdez responded by blockading roads near the World Trade Bridge and surprised his attackers with a fusillade of rocket-propelled grenades. In the wild gunfight that ensued, Guerra Valdez was killed with two other top Zeta commanders. On its surface, this was the commonest sort of drug war violence, with one important difference. Nuevo Laredo, a strategic crossing with a pliant police force and easy highway access to Houston, Dallas, and all points east, was now essentially leaderless. Seizing the moment, Guzman moved in. Once again, the kingpin conscripted a surrogate militia. This time, it was a hit squad called the Matasetas, or the Zeta Killers, which had recently emerged from within a rising powerhouse, the new generation Jalisco Cartel. Run by an upstart named Nemesio Oseguera, aka El Mencho, the Matasetas were exceptionally brutal, even by Mexican standards. When the fighting broke out in a second war in April, it was short-lived but appalling. Over three brief months, Guzman's deputized assassins hung their dead from bridges, set off car bombs, and dismembered scores of victims. In one attack, 14 headless bodies were discovered in a car near the local customs office. The heads were elsewhere, stuffed in plastic coolers in front of City Hall. As Guzman took control of Nuevo Laredo, there were problems at the call centers. Toward the end of June, the Mexican police launched an unexpected raid on one of his facilities in Tepic, and four young men from Culiacan, sitting in front of a table full of blackberries, were arrested. When the kingpin was informed about the raid, he immediately tossed out two of his own blackberries and seized three more from his wives and girlfriends, tossing them as well. His cutouts at the call center had been handling the messages flowing back and forth, and he feared that the devices had been compromised. 3 days later, despite these precautions, the police broke into his other call center in Tepic. Two more culichis, with two more blackberries, were detained. Something seemed to be going on. In less than a week, both his office-level workers and his telcel team had been taken into custody, and Guzman fretted about what it all might mean. The arrests in Tepic had come only 4 months after his own close brush with capture in Los Cabos. But what was the connection? Was there a connection? Just as he was struggling to piece things together, one of his girlfriends in Culiacan, she too had a BlackBerry, nervously got word to him that she was being followed by what may have been Americans. Something was definitely going on. But what? It remains unclear exactly how Guzman figured it out. But after the incidents in Cabo, Tepic, and Culiacan, he must have triangulated his suspicions and come to the conclusion that there was a mole inside his organization. Though he didn't grasp the full extent of the emergency and didn't know that Marston and Patash, still on his trail, had sent the police to Tepic, he nearly sniffed them out. Guzman reasoned that the culprit could only be one person, the young man who had access to his BlackBerries through FlexiSpy, Christian Rodriguez. Security being paramount, Guzman shut the spyware system down for good that summer, then sought to do the same to the traitor who had installed it, placing a contract on Rodriguez's head. As he often did with sensitive tasks, he gave the job of dealing with the young technician to his old friend, Alex Cifuentes. As Alex often did himself, he passed it on to his assistant, Andrea. In August 2012, Andrea was sent to Medellin on a mission to find Rodriguez and lure him back to Mexico. By that point, she had been working for Alex and Guzman for nearly 4 years and had traveled the world for them, acting as their avatar in meetings with film producers, corrupt army officers, and Montreal mobsters. She had moved their money, vetted their customers, and helped them purchase airplanes. But leading a man to his certain death, especially an innocent and a fellow Colombian like Rodriguez, was a line she wouldn't cross. Touching down in Medellin, Andrea sent word to the technician through two of her girlfriends that his life was in danger and he needed to leave the country quickly. After a day or two, she stalled for time and reported back to Alex and Guzman that even though she had searched for Rodriguez on Facebook and Google, she was not able to find him. When the two men pressed her for a lead, Andrea took another grave risk. She gave her bosses a false address, hoping she could throw them off the trail. Even if the address had been real, Guzman's killers would not have found their target. Around the time Andrea arrived in Medellin, Alex reached out to his mother in Colombia to warn her that Rodriguez was a turncoat and to let her know that the Spark, the encrypted system he had built for their family, could no longer be trusted. But his admonition, far more prescient than he realized, had come too late. Rodriguez still had access to the family's servers, and he ultimately listened to the call in which Alex told his mother that it had been confirmed 100% that the young technician was an American spy. Logging off in a panic, Rodriguez called Bob Patash. He was gone within hours, fleeing to safety in the United States. To anyone who understood how Guzman and his crew conducted business, it would not have been surprising to have learned that an assassination plot had gone awry when the man in charge of it accidentally revealed its existence in a phone call to his mother. Despite its reputation for efficiency, the Kingpin's operation was not always the crack criminal enterprise it was assumed to be. Though Guzman was savvy, he was also reckless, hindered by his own self-absorption and a circle of allies and underlings who were prone to missteps that might have seemed hilarious if they had taken place in a different, less deadly line of business. Alex Cifuentes was often the principal offender in this respect, but he was not the only one. His older brother Jorge was a pathological cheat who once shoved a helicopter off a cliff to collect the insurance. One of Guzman's early mentors, Juan José Esparragosa, nearly killed the organization's entire senior leadership one day by misfiring a bazooka. Cholo Iván Gastelum, the group's enforcer in Los Mochis, was in debt to his local gas station, and two of its workers in Honduras almost died while foolishly standing on an airstrip as an inbound drug flight veered off course on landing. Guzman's sons, meanwhile, especially his eldest, Iván Archibaldo, were feckless ne'er-do-wells with a taste for gaudy nightclubs and their own cocaine. When Iván was arrested in his early 20s, his release sparked the war with Arturo Beltrán Leyva. He underwent a psychological evaluation. The prison analyst found that he lacked impulse control and had a tendency to channel his aggression into the domination of those he felt were beneath him. At the same time, when he was asked to fill in the blank following the phrase, "I wish my father," Iván wrote, "was with me." It might have been expected that after the events in Cabo, Guzman would have gone to ground, cutting off unnecessary contacts and lying low until the heat of the moment passed. That he did neither, pushing instead into Canada, launching a new war of expansion, and carrying on like always with his lovers, suggests both his arrogance and carelessness. If personal security had always been his primary concern, ego and publicity were never far behind. Within 10 days of the Cabo raid, Forbes magazine had placed the kingpin on its annual list of billionaires for the fourth year in a row. Baseball caps were available on eBay emblazoned with the number 701, his initial ranking on the list. 5 days later, thousands of people flocked to the website El Blog del Narco to watch a bootleg video of Guzman questioning a suspected spy at Damaso Lopez's ranch. That same week, in March 2012, Marston and Patash, still collecting Flexi spy texts, caught the kingpin swapping BBM chats with one of his younger mistresses. The two were making plans for Guzman to withdraw some of his sperm from a cold storage bank in Guadalajara so that she could be inseminated at a fertility clinic in Culiacan. He had even returned to the enduring fantasy of making his movie. Though Guzman had just evaded capture by the FBI and the DEA, he invited his biographer, Javier Rey, to his safe house in Colonia Libertad to conduct more interviews for the El Padrino manuscript. Their deal by then was nearly on the ropes. Having secured the rights to Guzman's story, Rey had unwisely tried to strong-arm his subject into giving up 35% of the project's profits. Guzman, insulted, began to suspect that Rey was an informant. When the writer left Culiacan, the kingpin hatched a plot to lure Rey to his death with the promise of a quick advance payment. In a rare burst of scruples, Alex Cifuentes ultimately warned Rey of the plan. By that point, however, the kingpin no longer needed a writer. He had turned his gaze toward a bigger prize, the Mexican soap opera star Kate Del Castillo. Guzman had been obsessed with Del Castillo ever since he'd watched her performance in The Queen of the South, a telenovela from 2011 in which she had played his old friend, the real-life drug queen Sandra Avila Beltran. Vacationing in Cabo, he was even more enthralled when Del Castillo sat at her computer one night and wrote on Twitter, "Today I believe more in El Chapo Guzman than I do in the governments that hide truths from me. Mr. Chapo, wouldn't it be cool if you started trafficking with the good? Come on, senor, you would be the hero of heroes." The invitation, though absurd, closely synced with Guzman's own self-image. As soon as he got out of Cabo, he ordered Alex to get in touch with Del Castillo. All of this was taking place against the larger backdrop of a Mexican election that stood to have a decisive impact on Guzman and his business. After 6 years as president, Felipe Calderón had been barred by term limits from running again, and the three-way race to pick his successor, scheduled for July 2012, was not surprisingly a referendum on the most important policy of his time in office, his all-out war on Mexico's cartels. While Calderón's predecessor, Vicente Fox, had also taken a tough stance toward the traffickers, The outbound president had put the fight on steroids. From the moment he took power, in late 2006, Calderon announced that the military would assume control of subduing the country's narcos. Within a year, thousands of troops were deployed across Mexico on heavy-handed anti-drug maneuvers. Ski-masked soldiers patrolled the streets from Michoacán to Baja California. Army half-tracks were posted in front of police stations. Big cities and small towns alike began to look like villages in occupied Iraq. Calderón's crackdown had some notable successes. Under his watch, the military had killed or captured several cartel leaders, chief among them, Guzmán's longtime enemy, Arturo Beltrán Leyva. But the offensive ultimately led to as many as 60,000 deaths and left much of Mexico psychically battered and exhausted. In searching for a militarized solution to the violence, Calderón not only underestimated his adversary's capacity for mayhem, he mistook the traffickers as an external threat to the Mexican establishment instead of seeing them and the establishment as inextricably linked. By sending troops into his own despondent cities, he also managed to impose the terrors of state repression on the same population he had promised to protect. From the start of his sexenio, Calderón never fully grasped how deeply the financial health and welfare of his country were tied to narco-trafficking. By 2009, his third year in office, Mexico's gangsters were taking in an estimated $30 billion a year, second only to the total earnings of the national oil industry. Much of that money was injected back in the economy through follow-on payments to farmers, drivers, couriers, security guards, restaurant owners, real estate agents, and auto salesmen, not to mention bankers who quietly laundered untold millions in cartel profits. Calderón may have believed that he was fighting organized crime by pressing his campaign against Guzmán and his colleagues, but given the complicity of tens of thousands of ordinary people in the system, he was really fighting a block of his own constituents. Predictably, all three candidates who were seeking to replace him wanted nothing to do with this morass. Each of them, including the eventual winner, Enrique Peña Nieto, had vowed in their campaigns to refocus the drug war, but all were short on details as to how they might accomplish that or exactly what it meant. Peña Nieto, a handsome former governor with a sunny disposition and a glamorous second wife, ran on a slogan of "Tú me conoces, you know me," despite the fact that all that most people knew was that he had a gift for making speeches and had been born into a family with deep connections to the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI. After running Mexico for most of the 20th century, the PRI had been booted out of office in 2000 by Vicente Fox, not the least because it had a history of corruption and had managed the country for decades in a kind of power-sharing arrangement with the traffickers. During his campaign, Peña Nieto made the anodyne promise to spend less time and money chasing gangsters, and more of both, fighting the violence that had devastated ordinary Mexicans. His opponents attacked him and the PRI for appeasing the cartels and for wanting to restore their old agreements with the drug lords. While Peña Nieto angrily denied these allegations, refuting them even in his victory speech, the irony was that they might not have hurt him all that badly. By the time of the elections that summer, despair and weariness with the drug war had reached such desperate levels that many in Mexico didn't seem to mind if their incoming president had reached a new acuerdo with the mafia, provided, of course, that a respite from the bloodshed was included in the deal. Guzmán wasn't interested in the particulars of politics, but he had always been attuned to the ebbs and flows of political power. A few months after the election, he pulled Alex Cifuentes aside and told him about an intriguing message he said he had received from an unnamed source who was close to Peña Nieto. According to Alex, the source had advised the kingpin that the new administration, due to take office in December 2012, knew where he was hiding. In fact, it had a photograph of him from as recently as a few days before. But the president-elect, it was explained, saw no reason why Guzmán should have to continue living on the run if an accommodation could be reached. In Alex's account, The source put the price of that accommodation at $250 million. Peña Nieto had repeatedly denied that he sought a bribe from Guzman, and in assessing the veracity of the charge, it should be noted that Damaso López, who knew more than anyone about the kingpin's operations, claims he never heard of such a thing. "It is a lot of money," Damaso later said. It is also the case that Alex Cifuentes, the only man to have discussed the allegation in public, is a serial liar who cannot be trusted blindly. Still, as far-fetched as it sounded, Alex had heard something vaguely corroborative from his assistant Andrea Vélez. During the elections, Andrea was still working with J.J. Rendon, the political consultant who had helped to run the Peña Nieto campaign. Rendon, known for collecting samurai swords and binging on espresso, is a right-wing strategist who had often used his roguish brilliance to aid conservative candidates. Not long after Peña Nieto's victory in July, Andrea sent Alex a cell phone photo of a suitcase filled with cash lying around in one of Rendon's offices in Mexico City. She has since said that she isn't sure precisely how the money got there, but she has also said that she knows where it came from, her other employer, Chapo Guzman. A few days before the case appeared in Rendon's office, Andrea herself had given it to Guzman during one of her routine money runs. The cash inside, she said, was still packaged in the cartel's signature fashion, with $20 bills collected into rubber-banded bundles of $2,000. Andrea considered the whole thing to be strange, but she remains adamant that Rendon had nothing to do with funneling cash from Guzman to Peña Nieto. Rendon himself has vociferously denied the accusation. "JJ can be crazy," Andrea said, "but I've never seen him receive money from narcos, and I was very close to him." For his own part, Alex Cifuentes claims that Guzman never did in fact give Peña Nieto or anyone around him $250 million. Instead, he managed to negotiate the payment down to $100 million. Even that sum, Alex recalled the kingpin saying, had required a large and difficult increase in revenue. Just the sort of thing that extra shipments to Canada and a lucrative new smuggling route through Nuevo Laredo might provide.